Well, welcome back.
Thank you.
To more exciting material, I must say. I think it's getting even more interesting. Last time we talked about longing, and we talked a great deal, and we will continue. Oh, I can't believe I forgot. Ion. I even made myself a note, but I forgot where I put my notes.
There's a real indication.
We're right there with you.
We're there. Barb says you're getting there.
Yeah. I think I've arrived. This business of forethinking and pleasure.
Forethinking and pleasure?
Elijah and Salome, respectively, giving birth to meaning, which is not I. Does that all sound familiar?
Mm-hmm.
You asked a question last time, Tammy, about, this is just an aside, when did Jung first use the term collective unconscious? He first used the word primordial image in 1913. That's kind of where he is now. He used the word collective unconscious for the first time in 1917. That term, it seems to me, was in evolution all throughout his work, because here he's talking about it. Well, when he uses the word primordial image, as an archetypal image. But later, certainly by the time he's doing Zarathustra, he talks about it as also a process that happens in us and in the world, in the population of the world, like war, for example. So, but that's the direct answer to your question. We stopped at at 251. The idea we're going to continue with today is this business of Salome and Elijah. And we've been going on this for quite a while. Today we'll see why we reached the conclusion. I regret that I didn't bring an eye on. But you saw it last week, I think. Most of you remember that picture.
Are you talking about the picture of the lion and the snake right
there? Yeah.
Man, with the lion's face.
Yeah. Man with a lion's face with a snake wrapped around it. Yeah, I probably could have put it on here. I didn't make a note to do that. Let's just back up to the paragraph before where we stopped. Just as my thinking, see where I am? Second, page 251, first column, third paragraph. Just as my thinking is the son of forethinking, so is my pleasure the daughter of love, of the innocent and conceiving mother of God. Now, so we've done this before. It's the same thing we've heard. I think forethinking can be confusing. I would say, to be more current with our contemporary vocabulary, imaginative thinking, or imagistic thinking, or thinking in pictures. Remember the story I told you about the Basudo? Thinking in pictures. Why does he call that forethinking? Because that is the thinking process on which linear thinking is built. Imagistic thinking precedes logical thinking. That is to say, if you watch somebody's dreams who's coming up with a new idea, that new idea first appears in dreams as an image, and then later it appears in their thought process. So that rational thinking is a worked out thought contained in an image. For the artists here, it's what you're working with. That imagistic process is what he means by forethinking. Prior to linear thinking, and it seems to have the quality of anticipating the future. It's revealed. It comes to you. So, do you remember his dreams of the bloodbath and stuff? See how those images anticipated the future. That's why he calls it forethinking.
Gary, I'm wondering what's lost between the image and the thought. You know, when you're trying to take a dream and give it words, I never feel that it's quite full enough. So,
well, I think emotion.
Okay.
Nuance. Complexity. You could almost say there are two kinds of linear thinking. There's a linear thinking which is based on an image, and there's just linear thinking which is just crap. It's just, it can spin any theory it wants to. That's basically what academia is. It's just people sitting around thinking. But what Jung is working with is this thought process that is actually built on an image. I think also what you lose is accuracy, because thinking that's based on a image is a more accurate reflection of what's happening than just a thought. All thought has to do to be correct is to be non-contradictory. But a thought that's based on an image may be contradictory if it's true to the image, but it's much more likely to be an accurate description of what's happening.
That kind of explains why scientific gets over what it is lacking.
Yeah. And you know, Jung is working. I mean, he's doing so many things in this book here. One of the things he's doing is we have to change the way we think. We have to change our thought processes, because our thought processes have separated from the image, and we have to put it back together.
I thought Vanderpost did a really great job of saying how, you know, when Jung was doing the Black Book and the Red Book, every image was so important to him.
Mm-hmm.
And so that was nice to read that.
In a way, isn't that kind of how infants learn?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Infants speak in imagistic thinking. Definitely.
I'm a little confused. Isn't that the way an artist thinks also?
Yes.
So it doesn't have to go linear.
No, I think in and of itself it isn't. But we also have a need to conceptualize. That's also part of a human makeup.
Wouldn't that be sort of the forethinking?
No, the conceptualization would be taking the forethought and putting it into linear language.
Mm-hmm.
I think two things that linear language has that forethinking doesn't is it's easier to remember. And it leads to the possibility of action. You can draw a conclusion from a thought and then do something. But an image is just an experience. And it's got to be put up in the rational thought to become effective. Mm-hmm. But, of course, like Kathy said, the danger is, or like I said in response to Kathy's question, the danger is so much gets lost to the point where we don't even bother to think, is what is being said an accurate reflection of emotional reality?
Well, I just go through the same thing.
Yeah, and any artistic creative process starts with images.
And then you have to get what you see on the paper. That's what I'm hearing. I'm sorry, writers have that problem too, that there's an image, but then you have to get that image in words on the page. It's like artists have to use whatever they want to get. Okay.
So then, what would Jung say about that frustration that happens when you have an image in your mind and you can't find the right words, or you can't make your hands do what you're seeing? You know, that, I mean, that's so frustrating when you can't, you know exactly what needs to happen, but your hands won't do it, or the words don't. Mm-hmm. Aren't accurate, and you know they're there. It's not, you know, it's not, there are no words for this. It's like, why can't I find that right one? What would Jung say?
I think you have to incubate. You have to incubate that feeling or that image until such time as it gives itself up to rational language.
That's the stuff that makes you sleep with a gun by your pillow.
Or take Prozac.
Or booze, or what?
Yeah, it's terribly frustrating. Terribly anxiety-producing. And I think the art of working with this stuff is having the ability to stand the unknown, stand that anxiety until it speaks. And it really does speak in time. But it's maddening.
And that's why film is so wonderful, because film, you have the image there on the screen. Maybe it's different from what the person wrote, but it's the director's image anyway.
Yeah. Well, okay, so that's forethinking. So he says, as my thinking is the son of forethinking, so his thinking is rational thought, is born from imaginative thought. That is so critical. It's dream work. All of dream work, you see, is forethinking. And an interpretation is directed thinking, linear thinking. So is my pleasure the daughter of love? So he's working here with his attraction to Tony Wolf, I feel fairly certain, realizing that he's got to start with his pleasure to get to his love. Now, the thing that's hard for me here, and maybe it is or isn't hard for you, is I don't have any trouble recognizing that forethinking and pleasure go together. But I couldn't explain to you why. I think that's what's so hard. Why is it that he has to follow his pleasure to reach his imaginative thinking? I think that is simply the nature of imaginative thinking. But it's not something we're used to, and it's not something I can rationally explain. I think we just have to accept it as a just so fact.
I think the pleasure is the realization that you've had this for thinking. I mean, it's just sort of like an aha moment when you can get something into expressed in the way you want it to be expressed.
But he's talking about here about sexual pleasure,
okay,
I think.
I think.
I wouldn't limit it to that, but that's what he's dealing with at the moment, mm-hmm. I think.
I think it's because image and sensation go together. And
maybe that's it.
In Montessori, all of the sensorial works, which use the senses, lead into science. And so when you have children smelling things or shaking things or screwing lids on and off of jars, you're actually leading them to abstract thinking and scientific thought.
Maybe that's it.
And
yeah.
So it, mm-hmm. you can't have an image without having a physical feeling that goes with it.
That answers my question.
Yeah.
Well said, yeah. So you get what's going on, and see, what happens if the pleasure happens to be immoral? That's what he's wrestling with.
I was going to say, it's probably the same thing, but I was going to say, we don't really learn, do we, unless we have an emotion? So that they, and you said before, there's an image, and then there's, in the Kathy's question about what happens in between.
Mm-hmm.
And some people don't have an emotion, so they don't learn anything from it. But if you have an emotion, a true emotional response to that image, then that's when you learn. So the cognitive kicks in too. And then
well,
learn.
So you go body, emotion, image, thought. Something like that.
Yeah.
And that just seems to be the nature of the creative process.
As far as being immoral, sensation and images in and of themselves can't have moral. We tag
right.
emotion to it. So you can't... I have a lot of trouble with his whole relationship with Tony Wolf and what it put everyone through, but that's because of my history, my upbringing, my emotions. So I'm tagging things onto it that are not there. I mean, the sensation is.
Mm-hmm.
And so
that's what he's facing, I believe. At some points, one level of morality is suspended for another level of morality. That's the bitter pill here, I believe.
I think his statement is so helpful that there's nothing that's so evil that some good
mm-hmm.
out of it, and there's nothing so good that some evil doesn't. And that's his solution.
We'll get there in more detail with that too today. Well, then he gets to this bit that love is from the mother of God. Mary gave birth to Salome. I think the point of that, if you put it in Jungian jargon, is that all this comes from the self. There is an arrangement behind what is going on, he's telling himself. I think, I don't know if he comes out and says it right here, but I think it's fair to say this is his re-theologizing what the road to Christ and the road to Mary is. But that's another whole matter.
So, tell me if I'm just like going out way far off on a tangent, but is it possible that Mary gave birth to Salome because it was through her body that God came to understand humankind, so Mary was God's first physical sensation? Or is that just far out in the ether?
No, I think that's theologically valid. Where he would go with it psychologically, I think, is to say, you know, here I am being motivated with desire for this woman, but that has come from a higher source. And I've got to ultimately find the nature of that higher source to do justice to the meaning of what I'm feeling. And that higher source would be the self, and in practical terms again, that a new point of view is trying to come to birth through Jung's emotional experience. And that new point of view is not erotic or anything like that. It is a deeper insight into the human condition. And that kind of insight traditionally comes from God. Something like that.
And it gets back to what you were talking about, I think, the week before about longing. And that Wikipedia thing, that was wonderful. I just read it again this morning. It's just so powerful.
Yeah. Another way to put all this in a little phrase, which he doesn't have yet, but he will down the road, is spirit is embedded in matter. Matter is his desire, spirit is Jungian psychology, and the thoughts which will become Jungian psychology are being born in this erotic context.
What about Mary? What about Salome as the shadow of Mary? In the very beginning, before she transforms, Salome transforms in this. Mary is virginal. Salome is very phonic.
I'm always tempted to say Mary is a shadow of Salome.
Okay. But since Mary gave birth to Salome, I'm just thinking of an anima that's virginal in him.
Yeah.
To the shadow side of that, which would be, the thonic.
Yeah, I think you could say that.
Okay.
Yeah.
It almost seems like there's a bit of evolution in here, starting with the birth process
this
and then evolving.
This is the evolution of world culture, I would say.
It brings what Tony Wolf wrote about the four aspects of women. Mary would be the mother, Solomon might be the terror.
Right. Right. So you could say he met Hetera, but he was on his way to Mary, mm-hmm. to the mother. But the mother as the source of culture, the source of new ideas, new inspirations. We'll talk about this too later, the mother, because he's anticipating volume 5 here.
I mean, it's like those levels that Emma wrote about, the
yeah.
levels of the animus and the anima,
right.
the levels of development. was it Eve,
Helen, Mary, Sophia.
There you go.
So he's getting to Mary through Eve.
I keep having this thought, which can be irrelevant, but wouldn't it be true to say that God, or that life force, is amoral?
Jung certainly would. Actually, I think the Hebrews would. Christians tend to stumble there.
I think that's sort of how all the Darwin thinking starts.
How the?
Amoral. I mean, don't put a morality on it, but let it take the steps amorally.
I mean, morality is our human.
Yeah, once also, but you seem to be putting Christian morality on it.
Yeah.
And I say, Jung didn't have that problem when he did his dad.
Well, he had that problem when he got rid of it.
Yeah.
At considerable cost, I think. I think he had to get rid of it to do this. This is part of what he's struggling with here, is how do you get rid of Christian morality and not end up a bum?
He's too conscientious.
Yeah, because he was conscientious. Okay. That's that paragraph. Forethinking is the procreative, love is the receptive. So we're back to, see, we're just circling around Salome and Elijah from many different angles.
What'd you just say?
Forethinking is the procreative, love is the receptive.
Okay, thank you. I missed that again.
Uh, That's nothing new, right. But the next sentence is something to ponder. Both are beyond this world. That's a puzzle. Here are understanding and pleasure. We only suspect the other. It would be madness to claim that they are in the world. So much that is riddling and cutting coils around this light. I won the power back again from the depths, and it went before me like a lion. This is just reflection on what we've already heard. Sometimes we get the account of the experience, and then we get the reflection on the experience. This is the reflection on the experience. What do you think it means, that understanding and love are beyond this world?
That we experience some parts of it, but it's like Kant's thing about God. And we can know a little ant's part of it, but
yeah, exactly.
It's kind of it's
exactly.
It's sort of like a numinous experience too.
The idea is that thought is something that occurs separate from us, and we just plug into it. As if there's a world mind. Another way to put that is, there's thinking going on in the unconscious. There's a point of view being generated in the unconscious. And we simply hear it. So that we don't make up the thoughts. We simply transcribe them. I heard Marion Woodman put it, you know, the new worldview, it's already here. It's just inside us. And we have to hear it and bring it out. That's another way of describing the collective unconscious. There is a point of view in each of us trying to bring our consciousness up to the level of what's required to understand daily events.
And it speaks in images. So we're talking dreams, synchronicities.
Yeah, I'd say dreams of the collective, dreams from the collective unconscious, and synchronicities, to the extent that they're reflective of the collective unconscious. Reflective of the collective unconscious, like Jung having the dream of the war, mm-hmm. and then the war occurring. Jung having the dreams of the bloodbath, and then the bloodbath occurs.
And this is also a pleasure too.
Yes, that because you know we've established that creative thinking and erotic desire go together. So if the thinking is not an ego-centered phenomenon, then apparently neither is desire and love. That they exist independent of the ego and use us as their exponents. I think that's what he's getting at.
So there's a new point of view trying to come up from both of them.
Yes. Working together. And that's what he's, in a sense, saying to his moral critic. You know, this wasn't my idea, he's saying, in essence, but if I'm assaulted with this experience, what I find is both eros and imagination. And they go together. And that imagination will be the basis for his creating Jungian psychology after and within the disorientation of the split from Freud. So the riddling and cutting that quills around this light would be all those people who don't understand that it's not a question of making up ideas and arguing who's right. It's a question of hearing what those ideas are and then trying to articulate them. So because the tendency is to think that we have that idea, then scholar A argues with scholar B about who's right, rather than A and B working together to find out what is that pre-existent thought which is in us.
Why do we need that in politics today?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Certainly.
They
thought Trump was bad
on the day of 9/11. Like, why
didn't they
find out by the
18th? Yeah. Well, on that 9/11 stuff, you know, we talked, some of you have done the dream analysis seminar, remember the dream of the cross and the crescent? Mm-hmm. That was, I think that was the collision between Christianity and Islam 100 years ago. In the collective unconscious. And what is so special about that, a new light is born out of their conjuncture. So that new light is the new level of consciousness both we and the Arabs are being challenged to develop in this conflict. But who talks like that? It's all you, 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 you.
Mm-hmm. He talks like
that as
the Dalai Lama.
Dalai Lama does.
Except that he doesn't go into the pleasure part of the
That's
equation.
True. He doesn't go into the pleasure part.
Well, he has a different kind of pleasure.
Well, he actually came out against sex.
Ooh. That's why I said a different kind of pleasure.
Yeah. But, yeah, I think if there's anyone on the world stage who's attempting a more comprehensive point of view, it's him.
I thought last night in watching the room of that last miner, I did watch that. It was really the powerful image of bringing that those men up from, you know, under the earth.
Yeah.
And I don't know if that's when it was said, but they were commenting that why was that such a successful rescue mission? Mm-hmm. And the president of the country said, and he was there the whole time they were rescuing those people, mm-hmm. He said, we decided that we could not point fingers, that we had to not do that, and we all had to work together, and we had mm-hmm. to accept help from wherever we could get it if we were going to be successful. And we started planning as minute it happened, even though we didn't know if there was any more alive. But I thought that was so powerful. We decided we could not point fingers.
Mm-hmm.
And I was looking back at what we've done with the tragedies that we've had happen and how that's where it seemed to go rampant. Mm-hmm. Everybody's blaming everybody else and whose fault it is. And I thought that was really powerful.
That's very powerful.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yep. I won the power back again from the depths, and it went before me like a lion. We will see more of the lion, so let's hold off on that.
Was that his ego talking? I won the power back again.
Oh boy, you always got to figure out who's talking here.
Sorry.
I think that is his ego, and why it's not arrogant is because it goes before him like a lion.
Mm-hmm.
See, he's disidentified from the power. So that lion, I believe, is Jungian psychology.
And the power would have been his ego strength that is...
I think the power is the power to have created Jungian psychology.
Okay. And that's the positive power he's talking about in Zarathustra, that some people have power
mm-hmm.
and in that the ability to actually get things done. Like the president of...
Mm-hmm.
Which country was that?
Chile.
Chile.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, he had the power to get things done.
Mm-hmm. Okay, resolution. This means we're going to get to the resolution. And that's unfortunately all we have left of the image. of the...
Could someone get the light?
First initial. I don't know if you can see anything at all. See, it's chipped away.
And the first initial is what was on in German.
I don't know what the German is. Let me see. I have it here. What's that called? Resolution?
Mm-hmm. But then would it be resolution?
I can't make out. O-E... Olozung. L.
Okay.
L-O-E-S-U-N-G.
Okay, so that's...
Olozung. What's it, L?
Well, there are legs there at the very bottom.
You know what that is? That's the snake...
Mm-hmm. Going around the man.
Going around the man on the cross.
And maybe we would have seen the lion's face up there.
We might have.
Yeah.
Yeah, what a shame that's gone, huh?
I know. This is the ion image, you think?
I would guess.
Okay.
So this is where we're headed.
I also like that it's an equal-sided cross, not the Christian cross.
Right.
And the red, blood, passion.
Right.
Purple is sacrifice. Is that the color of sacrifice? In the Catholic Church, is it
purple is
the color of sacrifice?
Oh, no, is that blue or purple, though?
It's like purple to me.
Is that purple?
Carol, what's your opinion?
It's blue.
No.
It's purple.
To me, it looks like fire. Twilight, blue. Bluish purple. No, combined.
Mm-hmm. Maybe reaching. Is this the only image that's not there? No.
I don't know.
It was like, well, is it because we have to each find our own resolution, but I mean...
It's a little synchronicity?
Yeah, a little synchronicity.
And ink synchronicity?
It happened to be chipped away, then, that, or that the resolution is there. I don't know. It just feels like...
But it's weird that it's missing.
Mm-hmm. You also get a sense of the Alpha and Omega symbol.
That's what I was thinking. Mm-hmm. Where's the alpha? Where's the omega? But where's the alpha?
The cross, the way that the cross comes down from the middle. I mean, the alpha omega symbol is usually the A is behind the omega, and so it the omega is obvious. The alpha is kind of suggested to me.
Okay. Well, we'll go word for word for a while because we're going to end up with the resolution. Some of it we can go through faster than others. But on the third night, deep longing to continue experiencing the mystery seized me. The struggle between doubt and desire was great in me. That makes sense, huh?
Mm-hmm.
But suddenly I saw that I stood before a steep ridge in a wasteland. It is a dazzling bright day, and I caught sight of the prophet high above me. His hand makes an averting movement, and I abandon my decision to climb up. I wait below, gazing upward. I look to the right, it is dark night. To the left, it is bright day. The rock separates night and day. On the dark side lies a big black serpent. On the bright side, a white serpent. They thrust their heads towards each other, eager for battle. Elijah stands on the height above them. The serpents pounce on one another, and a terrible wrestling ensues. The black serpent seems to be stronger. The white serpent draws back. Great billows of dust rise from the place of struggle. But then I see the black serpent pulls itself back again. The front part of its body has become white. Both serpents curl about themselves, one in light, the other in darkness. Elijah, what did you see? I saw the fight of two formidable serpents. It seemed to me as if the black would overcome the white serpent, but behold, the black one withdrew its head, and the top part of its body had turned white. Do you understand that? I thought it over, but I cannot understand it. Should it mean that the power of the good light will become so great that even the darkness that resists it will be illuminated by it? Elijah climbs before me into the heights to a very high summit. I follow. On the peak, we come to some masonry made of huge blocks. It is a round embankment on the summit. Inside lies a large courtyard, and there is a mighty boulder in the middle, like an altar. The prophet stands on this stone and says, "This is the temple of the sun. This place is a vessel that collects the light of the sun." Elijah climbs down from the stone. His form becomes smaller in descending, and finally becomes dwarf-like, unlike himself. "Who are you?" "I am Mehmet, and I will show you the wellspring. The collected light becomes water and flows in many springs from the summit into the valleys of the earth." He then dives down into a crevice. I follow him down into a dark cave. I hear the rippling of a spring. I hear the voices of the dwarf from below. "Here are my wells. Whoever drinks from them becomes wise." Maybe we just put our heads to that a little bit before we hear what Jung says about it. Two snakes. Probably Elijah and Salome themselves. Or pleasure and forethinking and in battle. That's confirmed a little later on.
Sounds like yin-yang.
Yin-yang, absolutely. Yep.
Is it significant that this happened on Christmas? Footnote 206 says that the third night was December 25th, 1913.
That probably means something. You want to take a shot?
No.
It'd be a hell of a Christmas.
Yeah.
It's the birth of a new goblin.
Could be the birth of the new God in each, yeah.
I read
it. That's the darkest day of the year, too, so it would be the opposite of the lightest day.
Yeah, we'll come back to all this. I'm just not giving us too much before we reflect on it. Jung comments on all this, but I'm just trying my common sense would say. The black and the light. The black is also going to be the war, I think. And the white would be consciousness. That's putting it quite simply. Again, this is just my giving you some crumbs before we get to what he says. So that I think he's saying consciousness can make a difference to evil. In a way, you could almost see this is the prefiguration of Answer to Job. Answer to Job, his essay, where Job stands against God's destructiveness, and in Jung's mind initiates a process of reflection in God so that he becomes more moral. So here the white has an effect on the dark. Now, go ahead.
So on the one hand, the forethinking and the pleasure are beyond this world in the unconscious. And then on another level, they are conscious versus unconscious. Is that what you're saying?
Maybe like the principle of consciousness against the principle of unconsciousness. And then we are actors in that drama. But we don't write the script. And we'll see, you know, more of this coming up, where he talks about the relationship between the war and consciousness. What he says is almost disgusting, but we have to try to understand it. Mina, am I pronouncing that right? You know that? It's Mina, isn't it? Mm-hmm. We got a footnote here. I want to spend just a little time on that guy. He's a dwarf. What's so interesting, I think, in Wagner, he's a kind of a nasty guy. He steals the gold, which sets the whole opera in motion. They're trying to get it back. That's Alberich.
Yes.
Alberich, but Mima is his son, is it?
Brother.
Mima also raised Siegfried.
Right.
So that's kind of an interesting twist here.
Very interesting.
Took him into a cave.
What I'm trying to get at is he's not necessarily a positive figure.
Well, later he becomes a blacksmith. He's a forger.
In the opera.
Right.
Does he ever redeem himself for having a brother who's a criminal and raising a... But Siegfried is the one Jung killed.
Right.
See what I'm saying?
Right.
Does that ever come up in the opera or not? No, I don't remember either.
It's a long opera.
Yeah. I don't want to make too much of it, other than to say he's a little ambivalent. And it's odd because generally in myths, dwarfs are very positive. You've got to look far and wide to find a dwarf in fairy tales who's negative. Most of the time, they're very helpful. I don't know, is he a dwarf? Is he?
Well.
Yeah, they exist, but I would say, 90-10. So the fact that he's negative is something we want to keep in mind. Let me correct that. The fact that he appears negative is something we have to keep in mind.
You mean in Jung's vision?
In Jung's vision here. Anticipating, we'll see that he's negative because what he doesn't say things we like. So Jung is now coming to face, or is having imagery that anticipates the fact that what Elijah is going to tell him is not going to be welcome. That the spirit of the depths and the wisdom of the depths is not welcome to collective consciousness.
I think it's important to remember that Elijah becomes this dwarf, right? Elijah climbs down from the stone,
right.
His form becomes smaller, and he becomes dwarf-like.
Yes.
And he becomes Nineveh.
Yes.
That's important.
That's kind of what I just said.
Yeah.
He also is going to become a burst of light down the road. So you got this, I think, ambiguity that he has this brilliant insight, which is felt to be problematic. Again, anticipating. We'll see this later. But it's a significant image, I think. Okay.
Can I ask a question?
Yeah.
In footnote 208, it makes reference to analytical psychology.
Yes.
I looked in the text, and I didn't see anything that seemed to refer to that.
On page 96?
Yeah. Are they referring to this book?
No.
No, they're not?
The 1925 seminar, I believe.
Where is the West? It's the beginning of that. Mm-hmm.
Yes, thank you.
Yeah, I see that.
It's separately published.
Oh, okay.
You know, we did the Zarathustra, we did the Dream Analysis, we did the Visions. It's the first of that series.
But that's what this was,
and proof of it. That's the Tavistock collection. Yeah.
Okay, so I didn't know those were two.
Yeah. It's a slim volume. It's not his most interesting, but historically it's got some gems in it. We never did it in our series of study, but... Okay.
Is part of the fact that we don't like the spirit of death and what it has to say.
Yeah.
It's like Ming Neme brought up Siegfried, brought him up to
Albrecht. Albrecht brought him up, right?
No.
What's Albrecht doing here? Oh, Albrecht stole the gold. Mime raised Siegfried. Yes.
Right.
Okay.
And I was just thinking, you know, Elijah turned into Mime, and Mime brought up Siegfried.
It sounds like a circular mess.
And well,
because he just killed Siegfried.
But if Siegfried hadn't been brought up. Allowed to be brought up.
Keep going, right? Yeah.
Then this urge to power would not have become conscious.
That's it.
And so we don't like, I mean, if we see it in. So the spirit of the dead somehow knows that these things have to be raised, brought up into consciousness.
Yes.
And then we. Conceive that if we hear it and have eyes to see it, we can see it. We don't like it in that form, so we feel like Jung, we have to kill it in some form and keep the developmental constructive side. That
absolutely right.
Okay.
Yeah, that's good. I had understood that myself until we were talking about it. That. Elijah becomes Mima. Mima is the unpleasantness of the truth of Elijah, you might say. Okay? But damn it, Mima is the mother, so to speak, of Siegfried, and this whole thing started when we killed Siegfried. So what's Mima coming back when he gave birth to the very problem? But I think it's what you said. You can't kill power, you can only kill its manifestation. And it had manifested in Siegfried. The positive side of power is potency. And you might say the lion is the transformed Siegfried, because that's the power of the message, which has nothing to do with the ego, with simply that the message is needed and will find a place in the world. Does that make sense? So Mima is very ambivalent. He generates power. That power can be ego power, which is Siegfried, or it can be self power, which is the creative product. Where we see this in my work is if you've got a raving narcissist, big house, big car, you know, all that crap. I have to say to them, look, there is something very good about your narcissism. You love intensity. Now, we've got to find a way to live intensely that is not self-centered. And if they can pull that off, that intensity within the narcissistic drive to superiority becomes a thirst for meaning. But they can't give up intensity. And I think if you try to get them un-narcissistic, they leave because something in them knows they can't give up the need for intensity. Because that need for intensity ultimately is the need for the intensity of life lived through the self. Your life has got to become so interesting as to replace the buzz you get from being such a big shot. So that's the same kind of thing. That Mima can give birth to narcissism, or it can give birth to a life in pursuit of interesting and meaningful work.
And that seems like Mima's genius. I mean, he always saw the gem or the gold nugget within an apparent mess or negative.
And I think he's transforming his own power complex here, because he was a prick at the age of 30. And, you know, he was Mr. Zurich and the head of, you know, the psychoanalytic movement, living in one of the most expensive houses in the city, and he had all those trappings. And what he did then was turn that into a passion to create, not a passion to dominate.
So the ion is the transformed Siegfried.
The ion, would be the transformed Siegfried. Because remember in the vision, which we will get to, God willing, today, he is coiled around, a snake coils around him, and puts pressure on him, and he sweats blood, and looks and sees his face is turned into a lion. So that would be the ego power becomes the power of his message.
If the lion is the lion of prey, I mean, the animal of prey, right? So the snake has really transformed that animal. One instinct has transformed
another instinct.
Another instinct.
Right. But the lion's power is circumscribed by the snake. Snake's the one that's really got the power here. This is where we're heading, and maybe we should take a break.
And it says in the footnote that Mime raises Siegfried so that he will kill the dragon, which is the guy who's got the gold. He now has the ring.
Yeah.
And Mime has made this invisible sword for Siegfried to kill him with.
Right.
So he kills him, but then Siegfried kills Mime because he realizes that Mime is going to kill him after he gets the gold. So he's really just wanting the gold, and he does that. He's just using
right.
Siegfried. Okay.
Mm-hmm. But whatever Siegfried's doing, he's doing for power, I think,
right.
at this point.
Right.
So it's the same Siegfried in Wagner as in Mime's. Mm-hmm.